From NPR News, you're listening to the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturdays and Sundays. This episode, what the earthquake in Japan means for the global economy. Also, how a completely blind man was inspired by bats to learn how to ride a bicycle. Plus, more three-minute fiction stories and the Scottish Jewish chef who's taken his heritage to the extreme. Gefilte fish and chips and bacon-wrapped matzo balls. And the nerd MC, rapper Lupe Fiasco's childhood of PBS documentaries and chess tournaments, and how he became Jay-Z's favorite hip-hop artist. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. When disaster strikes anywhere in the world, Japan is one of the first countries to open its pocketbook. Japan is the second largest foreign aid donor in the world, due in large part to its huge economy. But given the billions of dollars in damage the country now faces, there are also concerns about what kind of impact it will have on the economy. Robert Madsen is a Japan scholar and senior fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies, and he joins me from Stanford in California. Robert, first of all, we are talking about a manufacturing powerhouse. Japan is a net exporter. Outline for us how the disaster could affect Japan's economy in the short to medium term.
The effects are different in the short and the medium term. You have to remember that Japan is a country that has been either in or on the verge of recession for over 20 years. Mm. And the major reason for that is that there's simply not enough domestic spending. In that sense, anything which causes the government to or companies to spend more actually helps the economy. And the precedent for this is the 1995 Kobe earthquake.
Right.
A great deal of damage was done to the economy. And over the next couple of years, companies and the government had to spend massive amounts of money rebuilding infrastructure and factories. So if we use that and apply that as an analogy to today's situation, in the short term, of course, because there's been so much disruption, growth will decelerate. But over the medium term, say the next 2 or 3 years, my guess is that there will be a massive increase in spending on plant and equipment and highways and ports. So Japan's economy is likely to grow significantly faster as a result of this crisis over the medium term.
Even though the economy shrunk last year. Let me ask you about oil for a moment, because, of course, we've seen huge spikes in prices in recent months, obviously because of the instability in North Africa and the Middle East. Now, given the unfolding crisis with those nuclear power plants in Fukushima, could that have the effect of increasing demand for oil?
If you look at demand for oil globally, because of the growth of India, China, a few other major economies, growth was trending upward very significantly. Now, if the events in Japan discredit nuclear power globally, we'll see China and some of these other countries cut back on their investment in nuclear facilities, which translates directly into much stronger demand for oil. So one of the things I would be worried about is that oil prices, which have been going up, are likely to go up significantly more. I think we're all going to pay a lot more at the pump.
Japan is also a major investor overseas. Could we start seeing Japanese money pulled from foreign markets? And if so, what kind of impact might that have on the global economy?
Yes. At least in the short term, Japan is going to have to repatriate a lot of the money it's invested abroad in order to pay for the reconstruction of all the factories and other things within the country that have been damaged. So that would suggest that the yen will strengthen in the short term. Money will probably flow out of the major Western investment markets, the U.S. Treasury market and other places, possibly pushing up interest rates a little bit. That, of course, will make things much more difficult for the Federal Reserve, because now they're going to have probably upward pressure on interest rates in the United States, which would mean they'd like to loosen. But they can't loosen if oil prices and other commodity prices are increasing, which now seems more likely. So I think in a number of different countries, this makes the conduct of monetary policy a lot more difficult.
That's some sobering news from economist Robert Madsen. He's a Japan scholar at MIT's Center for International Studies. Robert, thank you.
A pleasure.
Meet Daniel Kish. He's a man of many, many talents.
I like to hike.
I like to spend time in nature, listen to music, to do music, to write, to read. I like to spend time with kids.
I'm vegan.
I am a trained vocalist.
I like experiencing different cultures. I have friends in every country.
Oh, and one more thing. Daniel likes to bike. He's leading me on a bike ride as we speak here in Culver City in Los Angeles. And I've ridden with a lot of people before, but I have never biked alongside a person who is completely blind. And how does Daniel Kish do it? Well, with those clicks.
The method is called echolocation. Daniel calls it flash sonar. And he's helping to teach it to other blind folks through his foundation. It's called World Access for the Blind. And here's how echolocation works.
It's the same process that bats use. And it is literally a process of seeing with sound. So bats emit flashes of sound. And those flashes go out as flashes of light would, and they return to the listener. And humans can do the same sort of thing by emitting flashes of sound and receive enough reflection of sound to be able to construct images based on the pattern of those reflections.
Can you sort of give me a demonstration of it?
Well, a very simple demonstration is just simply getting clearly audible echo reflections from the immediate environment. So if I click, your microphones are going to pick up an echo from this building to my right. And that's the most predominant feature in this area. So when I walk into a new area, the first thing I do is I take stock of the most prominent features. So in this particular area, the three most prominent features would be that building, the umbrella in the middle of this table, and the tree behind me, and the canopy that covers this area. Okay. Now, further away to our left, there's another building that's slightly further away.
That's the NPR.
That would be the
NPR West building.
Yeah, that'd be the NPR West building. And this building has a much more defined reflection than this building, which suggests that A, the building must be at some sort of angle relative to us,
and it is.
And B, that it must have more texture to it. Pillars, alcoves, I don't know, maybe balcony structures.
It has a very high cavernous ceiling indeed.
Right. So those are the kinds of patterns that catch my attention, and those are the kinds of patterns of reflections that give richness to the images that are possible from sonar.
How did you start with the clicks? When you were a kid?
Yeah, I've been clicking for as long as I can remember. So I think that children are incredibly adaptable.
And intuitive.
And we know this. And I work a lot with children, especially very young children. And what I often tell parents when children lose their sight is warn and support parents to try and get themselves out of the way of the adaptation process and become more an asset to it than a liability, because children will adapt if given support to do so and given space to do so.
When you say support and space, is it that a lot of kids who are blind may at a young age start clicking but will be discouraged from doing it?
Well, the clicking is part of it. It's the overall process of being willing to reach out into the environment and discover what is around them. And if that discovery process is broken by introducing a situation that is not natural, such as keeping the blind child in a playpen or a crib or in the corner, or such as always guiding their hands around their environment or guiding their bodies around their environment.
You just have to let them figure it out.
You really do. You really
do. You just have to let them figure it out. If they get hurt, that's part of it.
Well, that is a big part of it, and that's a part of any child learning.
I mean, as a parent, obviously I don't have a blind child, but your instinct as a parent is for your kid not to get hurt, which is tough.
Yes, it is tough. But there's still a kind of an a priori difference. When a sighted child gets hurt, we consider it to be unfortunate. When a blind child gets hurt, we consider it to be tragic.
You're saying that it should be considered to be inevitable.
Inevitable and part of growing up. And we really need to kind of divest ourselves of that double standard.
I'm speaking with Daniel Kish. He's the founder of World Access for the Blind. It's a group that helps blind people
live independent lives.
Daniel, you decided, I guess about 10 years ago, that you wanted to help other blind folks live independently. You created a nonprofit. It's called World Access for the Blind. Can you tell me about what you do?
Our main focus is supporting individuals to access their environment better.
And this is not just about echolocation or flash sonar. It's not just about teaching clicks or spatial awareness. This is about a philosophy.
It is about a philosophy that we call no limits philosophy, which challenges us to challenge what we think we know, to challenge every boundary, every box, every limitation that we've either put up ourselves or allowed ourselves to be conditioned to accept.
In other words, most people would say, well, blind people shouldn't probably go too far out on their own, or, you know, their limitations, there are things that they shouldn't be doing. You're saying that's actually false. It's a false choice.
It's a false premise. It is a premise of what I call conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. Conventional wisdom doesn't favor blindness. Conventional wisdom basically favors the perpetuation of convention. And blindness is not conventional. It's anything and everything but conventional. So we tend to challenge conventional wisdom to expand itself and accept that there are situations and circumstances which are not conventional, yet which still warrant accommodation, consideration, acceptance, awareness. For example, one boy had lost his vision from an asthma attack, and they wouldn't provide him orientation and mobility.
That's essentially somebody who could teach him how to get around.
Yes, orientation and mobility, someone who could teach him how to get around. He was in a wheelchair because he'd lost the use of his legs in the brain attack, and also his vision. But because he had someone pushing him around in a wheelchair, it was seen that there was no need for orientation and mobility. Well, this went on for 3.5 years before I got hold of him. And I reviewed his situation, and I was able to mobilize other approaches to helping him move around. In this case, we were using a hiking stick. So we had him with a hiking stick in one hand and a long cane in the other. We also taught him flash sonar, and we taught him to use the little slivers of vision he had more efficiently. And within a year, he had left his wheelchair behind.
Hey Daniel, I read quotes from folks who work for National Organizations for the Blind. They aren't comfortable with you and with what you say you can teach blind people. Why do you think that is?
We have supporters and we have opponents. Mm. Anytime you have an established convention, the one who comes along and says that it can be done differently, it can be done better, it can be done faster, that person is seen as the renegade. And we are, I think, seen as renegades in many instances. We really want to bring the power of action back into the hands of the consumer, of blind individuals and of their families. Right now, it has been usurped by professionals and by others, in my opinion, and it's not going anywhere. So families and consumers, blind consumers themselves, need to step up to the plate and say, okay, well, this is what we want. This is how we get it.
That's Daniel Kish. He's the founder of World Access for the Blind. You can find out more about the organization and Daniel at our website, npr.org. Daniel Kish, thank you.
Thank you.
As we continue to read through the nearly 4,000 short stories you sent us this round of our 3-Minute Fiction Contest, we're bringing you excerpts from some of the standouts. We'll have a winner towards the end of the month. Until then, here are 2 more stories.
There's something that I wanted to tell you, something that has been bothering me for years. I broke your glass fly traps. You cursed your cat for breaking them, but it was me. You thought the traps were beautiful examples of Middle Eastern blown glass, but I would pity the fly inside. That's the law of life, you'd say. I hated those sayings, like, see you tomorrow if God lends us life. Lend us life? Lend me pesos. I have no money for dialysis back home, and Mexico is not America. Now I can cry. I promised myself no tears, so no tears. I'll see you in God's glory, you'd say. I'll be honest with you, I don't want to see you. And I wonder if I can see without eyes. But if I can't, but you can, look for me. I'll be wearing your lipstick.
I started to pass her the gun, but she said, one moment, and bent down to wipe the mud off her boots, and then to wipe her hands on her pants, and then to rub her pants with her hands. Then I ran into the meadow, arms spread out. The dirt was wet, and it pulled my feet in, but I kicked harder, running away from the gun and her. I saw the ducks spread out by the brown water. They exploded into a green firework rising above me. I was running into their wake and waiting, waiting for the crack of the shell to explode behind me, running with my neck down, even though I told myself I was not afraid. Then I was past the pond, still waiting for the crack to ring behind me. The ducks were cheering in the sky above me, and I turned around slowly. The gun was at her waist, and she was fumbling with something on the side of the barrel, jostling it against her hip. The ducks were far into the blue distance now, and their cheering was soft.
That's NPR's Bob Mondello reading from Duck Hunting by Michael Mount of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and earlier, NPR's Susan Stamberg reading a passage from Nora by Jesse Padilla of Normal, Illinois. You can find the full stories, read others, and learn more about 3-Minute Fiction at our website, npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. And that's 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. It's just before the doors open for the dinner rush at the Gorbals Restaurant in downtown Los Angeles. Inside the kitchen, soups simmer on the stove and sauces are frothed in a blender. The chef owner, Ilan Hall, watches his staff at work. Hall's just 28, and back in 2007, he became the youngest winner in the reality show Top Chef. And right now, he's putting the finishing touches on his signature appetizer.
Well, right now I'm taking a traditional matzo ball.
A matzo ball. Okay.
Wrapping it in bacon.
Okay. I don't think that my Polish-Jewish Safta Frida would approve of blessed memory, but let me watch what you do anyway. So what do you have here? You got
it's
a
very
matzo
simple.
Ball.
It's a pretty simple recipe, except in place of vegetable oil, we use either rendered bacon fat or lard. Because the pork fat makes it incredibly fluffy.
So this is a regular matzo ball that you would eat at Passover,
yeah,
or in a Jewish deli.
Yeah.
And you're mixing it with the most unkosher food possible.
The most unkosher.
But the result is?
The result is lovely because there's something about the bacon fat when it's roasting in the oven that sort of gives it this delicate sort of crumbly fluffiness that just doesn't exist when you use other types of fat and when you don't wrap it in bacon. And it almost takes on the texture of a really, really light meatball.
The bacon-wrapped matzo ball. Call it a hybrid of Ilan Hall's iconoclastic style. And it's what's made the Gorbals one of the hottest restaurants in L.A. The restaurant offers the most unlikely combination of cuisine, Jewish and Scottish. And when I sat down with Ilan Hall at the Gorbals this week, he explained where the idea comes from.
My mother's from Israel. My father's from Scotland. Both Jewish. And I feel like when you really want to make your best food, you need to go back to your roots and where you're from and where your bloodline's from. And that sort of is where it all came from.
So this is what you grew up eating?
Not bacon-wrapped matzo balls. But I grew up with influence from everything. I grew up with a lot of Mediterranean, Israeli influence in our food. So my father was the cook of the house, and he loved to cook. But he always loved chips and haggis and all the...
delicious stuff.
Delicious, yeah. Hopefully lovely bits.
Extremely healthy food.
Schmaltz and kishka.
First off, tell me about the name, the Gorbals.
The Gorbals is the neighborhood that my father grew up in Glasgow.
In Glasgow.
Yeah, it's right on the River Clyde, and it was a bit of a slum when he grew up there. Very rough neighborhood.
Jewish neighborhood at the time?
Partially Jewish, lots of immigrants. And that's where he spent his formative years.
You have, you've taken this kind of this combining these two cultures to, I guess it's to its natural place, right? I mean, you've got latke and pork belly hash, things like you offer up gefilte fish and chips. Pork belly braised in manischewitz.
It's delicious.
The sweet kosher wine that many Jews use on Sabbath. How does manischewitz make pork belly taste better?
Well, pork belly lends itself really well to sweet cooking preparations.
Right.
And so when we were doing it, we were braising it coq au vin style, almost like they do in France with braised chicken. And so we did it like that. We would marinate it overnight and then slow cook it in the manischewitz and then glaze it with it and made this beautiful bright red purple crust on the outside of it. Very, very good. It's not for the sake of being offensive, I promise.
But one critic who I should say gave this restaurant a great review and gave you a great review, he called it confrontational cooking, that it's food designed to provoke people. Obviously, Jewish people who are kosher may not find it so amusing.
Well, we needed to get people's attention. We're stuffed inside the lobby of a very nondescript building. So here in downtown LA. So we don't have lots of street presence. So I really wanted to do something that would get people's attention.
Hmm. Did you grow up eating matzo ball soup at Passover?
Absolutely.
And,
yeah. I grew up with lots of traditional Jewish foods.
How did you come to deciding to wrap a piece of bacon around it?
I was making a birthday menu for a friend of mine, and totally as a joke, he's a fellow Jew. When I submitted the menu to him, I told him that I was going to put bacon wrapped matzo balls on it. And he thought it was really funny, and I had no idea how they were going to turn out, and it turned out to be unbelievably delicious.
So clearly you are not going after the Jewish deli crowd.
No. Well, yeah, I mean, not everybody keeps kosher. In fact, most of the negative response that I've gotten for dishes like that have not been from Jews at all.
Oh, really?
They've been from people that just, you know, want to be offended for the sake of it. The Jews find it incredibly funny, actually.
I'm assuming that I read that you grew up on Long Island.
I did.
And
great.
I should mention that as we're speaking, food is coming onto the table. We just got some, what are these, are latkes?
These are the latkes with smoked applesauce.
With a smoked applesauce.
Yeah.
Looks great.
We use the same...
Potato latkes, traditional potato latkes. Any twist in there?
Not really.
Bits of bacon
No, no bits of bacon. We just use fresh herbs inside and Kennebec potatoes, which are what In-N-Out uses for their fries.
I love those fries. In fact, I had some today. First thing I do when I land at LAX,
I know lots of people that do that.
Both your parents are Jewish. Mother's from Israel and father is from Scotland.
Yes.
I'm assuming you did not grow up in a kosher home.
I didn't grow up in a kosher home. In fact, my grandfather on my mother's side was a kosher butcher in Germany, in Jerusalem, and in New York.
I should mention that I noticed some pig's heads in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah. We do whole roasted pig heads.
So you do have butchering in your blood.
Oh yeah. No, I have lots of he was a wonderful
Probably
butcher.
Probably not adept with a
But he was a kosher butcher, but what's ironic is that when he lived in Israel, you couldn't get non-kosher food, you couldn't get pork products anywhere. So what he would do, he would have it smuggled in through Lebanon.
Oh really?
And not to sell in a store, it was just for personal consumption, but it was all big hush-hush because you know, he couldn't let the community know, because he was a kosher butcher, he couldn't let the community know that he was smuggling in pork from, you know.
So he would be proud of you.
Yeah, I think he'd be very proud of me.
That's Ilan Hall. He's the chef and owner of the Gorballs here in downtown Los Angeles. To find out how to make his famous bacon-wrapped matzo balls, but please don't serve them at Passover, visit our website, npr.org. Ilan, thanks.
Thank you.
And let's eat. Washalu Muhammad Jaco grew up in rough neighborhoods in and around Chicago in the 80s and early 90s. Crack addicts and prostitutes would pass out on the front stoop. But inside his dad's apartment, National Geographic was on the coffee table and PBS documentaries played on the TV. Washalu's friends drifted in and out of jail while he joined the chess club and the academic decathlon at high school. He was also a drama geek. This is the story of Lupe Fiasco. That's Washalu Jaco's stage name. And Lupe Fiasco
is arguably the most innovative rapper to hit the scene in more than a decade.
It's a spy from behind my giant robot's eyes. I keep him happy because the mic fall out if he cries. Scared of heights, so I might pass out if he flies. Keep him on autopilot because I can't drive.
He raps about cops and drug dealers, but he's also been known to quote Nietzsche, Orwell, Chomsky, and Howard Zinn. Lupe Fiasco's been called the Geek MC, and his long-awaited third album is now out. It's called Lasers, and Lupe Fiasco joins me from Tampa, Florida. Lupe, a great pleasure to have you on.
I appreciate it, guy.
And I should mention that the song we're hearing, Daydreamin', which is so beautiful, that you did with Jill Scott, won you a Grammy back in 2008.
Yeah, my first and only Grammy.
I fell asleep beneath the flowers. You've been called, and I say this with the utmost respect and solidarity, you've been called a geek, right?
Geek is so harsh. What about a nerd?
A nerd, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, nerd is softer.
But I guess somebody who kind of celebrates the idea of being an oddball, like almost kind of like a living juxtaposition. Are you those things?
I'm quite against the grain. You know, it's weird. It's that duality. You know, everybody has their quiet, guilty pleasure. You know, so you might have like the gangster in the streets who collects comic books. You know, you might have the convict or the drug dealer, you know, who likes Teletubbies. You know, I may have a collection of Beanie Babies.
And those are people that you knew and grew up with.
Yeah. I always saw two sides of life. Me, I choose to just kind of live both of them, you know, with really no fear of any critique or anything like that.
Your folks divorced pretty early on when you were a kid, and you were raised by both your mom and dad. You went back and forth between their apartments. Your dad was a Black Panther. He ran community centers, and he turned you on to all different kinds of music. I mean, we just heard that description of crack addicts and prostitutes outside the house, but inside you would be exposed to all of these different ideas and books and film and sounds. Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, my mother had a massive collection of National Geographics and, you know, PBS in Chicago's WTTW is, you know, my window to the world is what I would watch. And when I was with my father, you know, my father had a massive collection of vinyl, you know, a ton of Ravi Shankar vinyl and then a set of bagpipes, you know, and these vases from China. And then it would, you know, it was just all these little knickknacks and pieces of the world kind of strewn about the house. So it was a very interesting childhood.
Did you feel like an oddball? I mean, in your neighborhood growing up?
My father very, very well broadcasted that we were different, you know, whether it be that we had, you know, his pickup truck had a bullhorns bolted to the front of it with a stagecoach, you know, kind of canvas thing that he mounted on the back of it, you know, so we looked like a caravan going west, you know, whenever he went through the west side of Chicago.
In the streets of Chicago.
In the streets of Chicago. My father was very flamboyant. You know, he was always down to make a statement.
So much of obviously your dad's influence, musical influence, is obvious, especially when it comes to jazz. And you hear it so clearly on one of your best known songs called Superstar. If you are what you say you are, a superstar, then have no fear, the crowd is here. Talk to me about how you think about integrating those kinds of sounds and what you do.
From that, you know, experience with my father and with my mother as well, but more so with my father when it came to the actual music, you know, you get introduced to all different forms and types of music, you know. So I have a understanding of Queen, you know, and the way Freddie Mercury did his harmonies, and I know what tabla sound like because my father played a lot of Usted Allen and Khan, and you know, it was all this mix and mash. So when I got the opportunity for me to make music, it was like, oh, yo, let's get the djembe, you know, or, yo, I'm familiar with this jazz kind of thing. Let's use that. I can't make music. You know, when I say make music, I cannot play any instrument for the life of me. But at the end of the day, I know what I want to hear.
I'm speaking with Lupe Fiasco. He's a man Jay-Z called the most creative rapper in the business. His new record is called Lasers. It's so loud inside my head. The latest single from this new record is called Words I Never Said, and it's a political song, but it's also a very personal song. It's a song in which you address your Muslim faith. Let's take a listen.
Now we can say it ain't our fault if we never heard it, but if we know better, then we probably deserve it. Jihad is not holy war. Where's that in the worship? Murdering is not Islam, and you are not observant.
Jihad is not holy war. Murdering is not Islam. You are a Muslim. You grew up around all these potentially dangerous influences, drug dealers and guns, violence, prostitutes, and yet you sort of managed to keep out of it, even though you were familiar with it and comfortable in that world. How much of that do you think was because of your faith?
A piece of it. You know, the one thing I always say is I was born Muslim, but for a large part of my life, I wasn't necessarily raised Muslim. Mm. But, you know, Islam was always there. And other religions and other practices as well, because my father always kept everything around us from Western philosophy to Eastern philosophy. We used to go to Juma on Fridays and then turn around and go to church, you know, on Sundays. So what it built me up to have was a moral compass, you know. So I've never, for instance, on a small note, I've never, you know, drank alcohol before. You know, I've never smoked before in my life. You know, when I'm in a city or anywhere in the world, I always try and find the halal restaurants, you know, to eat at, whether it be fast food or what have you. So there's certain little things that pop up. But then at the same time, too, you know, there's a certain level of I'm comfortable living in the secular world.
You have been known to use, you know, experimental rock in your music, including music from Radiohead, like this song. It's called Us Placers.
Lifestyles of the rich and famous. Bought a big house and a whole lot of ranges. A fresh new couch and a whole lot of trainers. A closet full of clothes and some brand new dangers. And some Mexican floral arrangers. A great big TV that'll entertain us. Some colorful commissions from some high paid painters. Someone to take the rap so that I stay stainless. And a new relationship with a banker. Two pinky rings for my manicure fingers. A trained German shepherd that bark when it's anger. To watch my possessions and look out for strangers. And a 50-foot yacht with an anchor. A young supermodel that shall remain nameless. Ups and the downs, the sames and the changes. All the money in the world don't make it painless, no.
I can listen to this song 1,000 times. It's such a, it's such an amazingly beautiful song. Do you see your music as a kind of a bridge, like a gateway for people maybe who aren't instantly attracted to hip-hop, maybe to come into it through your music?
Yeah, you know, and I actively kind of put out there that I feel like I try and communicate between, you know, if it's, it could be as on the surface as between genres, but between communities that wouldn't necessarily talk, you know. So, like, you take a song, for instance, like Kick Push, you know, which was my first kind of big record off my first album.
Which is an anthem for skateboarding, or has become a skateboarder anthem.
Yeah.
Check it out. First got it when he was 6, didn't know any tricks. Matter of fact, first time he got on it, he slipped, landed on his hip and busted his lip. For a week he had to talk with a lisp like this.
So you take, you know, black kid talking about skateboarding, and it crosses so many barriers, because that is one thing that, you know, a lot of kids have in common. You got, you know, black kids in the hood who skateboard, you know, and you got, you know, white kids in the suburb who skateboard. So it's kind of those, trying to find those universal kind of elements and trying to connect them together, you know, so that creates like a bridge. It creates a means of communication and relativity where you both can kind of be like, hey, we both interested in the same thing. Like, yeah, you know, and it's less about the skateboarding and more about the story behind it, you know. So that's kind of like my same thing, my same approach to music.
That's hip-hop artist Lupe Fiasco. His new album, Lasers, is now out. Lupe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, guy. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Thomas Pierce and produced by Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Petra Mayer, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Our intern is Megan Kane. Mothoni Maturi is filling in for Rick Holter as our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next Sunday with the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. And remember, you can hear the full version of the program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon.
Ain't nobody leaving, nobody going home. Even if they turn the lights out, the show is going on. All right, all right. The show goes on all night till the morning. We dream so strong. Anybody ever wonder when they would see the sun? Just remember when you come up. The show goes on.
summer.